Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence we are privileged to tap with some regularity is that of Daniel Horowitz. He is one of the driving forces behind Conservative Review. He has a column there, The Conservative Conscience. He is an author. He is a video maven. He is a tremendous resource, particularly on some of the most complicated issues we confront, one of which at the moment, of course, is immigration. Daniel Horowitz, it's so good to have you back. Thank you for taking a few minutes to talk about this rapidly unfolding story.
Absolutely. Great to be with you in this very fast-paced week.
It is, and even as we speak, there are developments that will be playing out today subsequent to our conversation and before this program airs, one of which, of course, is President Trump going to the Hill to meet with the House Republican caucus on this issue of immigration. Daniel, if you could just set the stage for this meeting. The president has signaled both support for and opposition to, and then again support for, what's come to be called the Ryan Amnesty Bill. Do you anticipate that that will continue to be support? And if so, why?
Well, I'm hoping that, you know, since they scheduled these bills last week, we had this sea change in the media narrative, all of a sudden now focused on the so-called separating kids from their parents. So my hope is that that's going to harden Trump's determination to steer away from amnesty, because amnesty is really the problem. It's not the solution. And, you know, let's call a spade, Frank. Americans don't matter in this debate. I mean, I think we see that very clearly. The gangs, the drugs, the up to $33,000 a year cost for these UACs to be in American schools. All the problems we have, fiscal, social, security problems, don't matter. What grabs the political class's attention on this issue? Only when they feel that illegal immigrants are being harmed. Now suddenly they care about the border. But here's the good news. The same impetus for the problems plaguing Americans because of illegal immigration is the same impetus plaguing the migrants themselves. And that is when you incentivize through amnesty, through catch and release, that if you come here, you're going to be given benefits, that you're going to be allowed to stay, especially with a kid. You're going to be counted in the census. If you have a baby, it will become a kid. We have to give you welfare, education. It's going to encourage more migration, which not only hurts Americans, it hurts those very people who become, you know, victims of sex trafficking, rapes at the border. And frankly, you know what else is happening? When you bring in so many bad people with the, you know, innocuous people, those innocuous people that are supposedly fleeing Honduras, guess what? They're coming to Honduras and MS-13 in our own cities. And the Washington Post has documented that in the schools. So, I mean, this is the broader messaging that I'm hoping the president takes away, that the separating the kids outrage is a symptom of the problem and not the problem.
Daniel, the degree to which the public safety, as well as all of those other equities that you talked about, you know, the budgetary implications, the impact on schools, the impact on communities, is really extraordinary. And you mentioned this media narrative. I think it's fair to say that that is not something that just suddenly became topic A for the media. This is part of a calculated effort on the part of the open border crowd, of which, as we've discussed in the past, there are both Republicans and Democratic members. But to the extent that all of this is sort of causing, in a monomaniacal focus, only the issue to be defined in terms of whether children who may or may not belong to these illegal aliens are separated from them, really is a disservice of the first order. So the president may come into this meeting braced up, as you say. He certainly was sounding pretty bullish about this yesterday, talking about how the United States is not going to become a detention facility and the like. But talk for a moment, if you would, too, about what the stakes are for the Trump presidency if he winds up throwing in with the Ryan amnesty team and its ilk.
You know, it all comes down to the budget bill, and that's really everything. You cannot get good legislation through the legislative process past Congress. You know, the Democrats oppose it in the Senate, obviously, and many Republicans are really what I call MS-13 Republicans. I mean, all the Republicans that care more about the MS-13 members than about Americans. He's not going to be able to get that through. His leverage is through the veto power of budget bills. You know, he failed to threaten the veto with the first two fiscal year bills and signed really bad bills. This is his final chance. And as we're talking, I'm seeing a headline where Trump is actually threatening a veto and a showdown with government funding. That's the only leverage. And he needs to stand up there every day of the week, shame these people on their views, give televised addresses about the dangers to America and as well as the migrants, that you can never have proper migration when the drug cartels control the smuggling and it's not in a safe, controlled environment. It has to be done in your country of origin. He needs to codify that in the budget bill. He needs to cut off funding to sanctuary cities and the border wall. And again, he needs to leverage a veto threat against any bill that doesn't achieve that. If he fails to do that, my fear is he's going to be convinced that, well, the only way I'm going to get my priorities is if I play ball with amnesty and the legislative agenda. And if they pass this bill out of the House, which has a massive amnesty, now it does have some good provisions on enforcement and legal immigration cuts. But the problem is once that passes the House, they'll pocket the amnesty in the Senate, jettison the other provisions, and, you know, just have some talking points. And my fear is the president will say, look, this is the best I can get. That's why I don't think he should play ball at all with any of these bills and just go straight for the budget.
And if he does wind up playing ball and the Congress is on record in favor of amnesty, it seems to me pretty clear you will have an awful lot of people in the base staying home. And it doesn't take that many for it to be a decisive factor in this upcoming fall election and likely result in a democratically controlled House at the very least, and probably an impeachment of the president thereafter. Daniel, before we run out of time, we've got another minute and a half. Very quickly, at the heart of all of this, of course, before the separation issue preoccupied everybody, it was the plight of the DACA kids, so-called DACA kids. You have done some very important reporting on a question about who are these people anyway, and why don't we know all that we should about them?
You know, what's amazing is Congressman Steve King obtained the exclusive data from USCIS. I think since then they've posted some of it online, and he gave it to me to analyze, and I wrote about it. That basically, they did not upload into their electronic database basic information on criminal records, education attainments. You know, we're all told that they're all valedictorians and graduate high school and college. And that data wasn't even put into the system until late 2015, 3 years into the program. And what we do know, it seems that 60,000, at least 60,000, had criminal records and got status, initial status, and renewals. Only a tiny percentage have verified education attainment. A lot of them, there's no verification.
Daniel Horowitz of Conservative Review, we have to leave it at that for the moment. But thank you so much for this important update. And I look forward to talking with you after we find out what the president's going to say and then the House decides to do later this week. Kevin Freeman joins us next on Economic Warfare and More.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. It's a pleasure to say, joined by Joseph DeGeneva, one of the really extraordinary resources for both this program and most of the free world at the moment when it comes to matters involving the threats that we're facing to our republic from the kinds of problems that have now become manifest since the election of Donald Trump, the deep state, the efforts of participants in our federal bureaucracy to undermine the rule of law, and not least to overturn the democratic election of
Donald Trump as president of the United States. Joe is a man who knows his way around the law. He is the founding partner of a law firm, DeGeneva and Tensing. He's a former U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia. He has served in a variety of other extraordinarily important capacities, notably as an independent counsel in connection with the Clinton passport file search scandal. He's also been a chief counsel and staff director for the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is much in the news at the moment. Joe DeGeneva, it is a great pleasure to have you with us. I know you are overseas at the moment, but we're very appreciative of you taking a few minutes to talk with us about, among other things, this new report by the Inspector General of the Justice Department, Michael Horowitz. Welcome back, sir.
Yes, thank you very much, Frank.
So what are we to make of this report, Joe? You've, I gather, had a chance to take stock of it.
Well, I think the report suffers from cognitive dissonance. The facts are set out, and then the conclusions seem to be from the planet Mars. The notion that the Inspector General could conclude, after laying out the facts that he does, that there was no political bias in the investigation of Hillary Clinton, that is, a bias in her favor, is ludicrous. And I think that it does a disservice to the process to say things like that. I know that the Inspector General doesn't want to draw conclusions beyond the limits of his abilities, but I also think it's important not to ignore the obvious, because the Department of Justice and the FBI are now suffering from a failure of confidence and integrity that is destroying both institutions. And regrettably, I find the people that are leading both of those institutions, Rod Rosenstein and Chris Wray, the FBI director, are not up to the task. I would say that the IG's report does, however, indicate just how far the FBI has fallen. It's quite obvious that a number of high-level people, from Director Comey all the way down to Strzok and Page and others, on the seventh floor where the executives of the FBI work, was infected with a pro-Hillary Clinton bias with regard to her email server investigation, and also infected with a virulent anti-Trump animus, well beyond a bias, which included language from one agent named Peter Strzok, which was, if Trump tries to be president, we'll stop him. I must say, this is the lowest point in the history of the FBI.
Yeah, it really raises a profound question, both as to what was going on, as you say, on the seventh floor, but also what was going on with the Inspector General. I know that you were among those, Joe DeGeneva, who was expecting something along the lines of the content of this report. But what do you make of the fact that he arrived at this seemingly disconnected, if not Martian, conclusion?
Well, I just can't explain it. Because when you do the kind of digging that he did, and you have the right to do it and the power to do it, I don't understand why you would pull punches. And it clearly seems to me that he's pulled punches. Now, he knows all of these people. He's worked with them for years. Bob Mueller, James Comey, all the senior people in the Justice Department. I mean, clearly the conduct of Loretta Lynch and Sally Yates and all of these people was simply abysmal, in the worst sense of the word political and abysmal. Now, I am aware that there is a secret addendum to his report, which the public has not seen. I don't know if the Hill has seen. I think they must have, since this is a report for them, which may lay out more detail. But if that's the case, then he should have alluded to that fact in the public report and should have said whether or not his conclusions were affected by it. So I'm at a loss. I just don't understand it. And I have to tell you, I'm extremely disappointed in the conclusions of the report. I mean, you read the report and then you read the conclusions. It's like two different worlds.
Yeah. You know, it's ironic that it's somewhat reminiscent, Joe DeGeneva, of the disconnect between James Comey's laying out in that famous July press conference in 2016 the case against Hillary Clinton, and then coming to the conclusion that no prosecutor would bring that case. I know you've talked about that in the past as preposterous, but this seems this investigation into, among other things, that very behavior seems to bespeak much the same sort of punch pulling, shall we say?
I think that's an excellent comparison.
Yeah. There are two interesting sort of responses to this report. On the one hand, Donald Trump and his camp seem to feel vindicated by it, in terms at least with respect to his firing of James Comey, as insubordinate as even the Inspector General feels compelled to say. And Hillary Clinton's team also seem to feel as though they've been vindicated, that this has in fact shown that there was interference by the FBI, by the Department of Justice in the campaign, and it might have come out differently had that not happened. As you weigh the evidence, Joe, who has the better case?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that President Trump has the case. Hillary Clinton has no case. Hillary Clinton violated the law when she set up that private server at her residence in Chappaqua, New York. That was the original sin that started all of this. It led to the compromise of highly sensitive national security information. It led to the breaching of her server by foreign intelligence services. It led to information that could ultimately be used to compromise her as president of the United States. She has nothing to complain about. I would say this. I think she does have a right to complain about James Comey's news conference, the way it was conducted. Of course, it wasn't really a news conference because he didn't take any questions. He accused her of a series of crimes, gave the evidence for it, and then said that no one would ever prosecute the case, no reasonable prosecutor. That was an outrageous abuse of power. I personally think that his entire conduct is worthy of a federal grand jury to investigate what his motivations were and other things. So she has a right to be mad about that, and I would have been. She also has a right to be mad about his letter to Congress reopening the investigation. He was under no obligation to do that, and he should not have done it. As far as the president is absolutely vindicated by this report. It shows that the political bias that infected her investigation infected a false counterintelligence investigation of him. I see today that Agent Peter Strzok's lawyer has said that Agent Strzok wants to come up and testify so he can explain himself, and he has every reason to believe that what he acted properly. I welcome his opportunity to testify. I just hope that the people questioning him can get their heads screwed on straight for once. They ask some good questions. The first one being, why did you say that you would stop President Trump from becoming president? What an outrageous notion for an FBI agent of senior status to be espousing.
Joe, listen, if he is going to testify, it seems to me the chances that the questions put will be as they need to be if you're staffing them once again. So I hope you'll be of counsel if asked to serve. Listen, Joe, two other quick questions. One is, I know there's been talk, you and I have discussed it in the past, you've done it elsewhere, about the need for yet another special counsel. In light of what we've seen from the Inspector General, do you still think that's required?
Yes, I do. I don't believe the department is capable of investigating itself any longer. I think that the Department of Justice and the FBI have fallen so low in professional responsibility and integrity that they cannot be entrusted with the responsibility to investigate something as grave as the manner in which they broke the rules for applying for Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act warrants. It's now been established beyond any doubt that the court was lied to, that people broke the law, and that they obtained surveillance warrants illegally. That is something that is so grave in our society that we simply must have an independent investigation, an independent criminal investigation with testimony before grand juries. That's, I'm sure, why James Clapper today called for an end to the Mueller probe, fearing that it would get close to him.
Yeah, well, it certainly should, and almost certainly would if it's properly conducted. This would be, of course, in connection with the whole issue of the president or his campaign having engaged in some kind of collusion with the Russians. Joe, let me lastly ask you the question that has been bruited about a bit. Rudy Giuliani weighed in on it again over the weekend, as you know, is this issue of whether the president should sit down with the existing special counsel, Robert Mueller, and answer such questions as he might want to put to him for the purposes of finishing up this probe of the so-called collusion charge. Your recommendation on that?
Well, under no circumstances should the president agree to an interview with the special counsel. There's no basis for it. There is no evidence that any collusion with the Russians occurred. And there's, of course, no evidence that the president was personally involved in anything whatsoever. So I think the only reason that Mueller wants to speak with him is because he is putting together a report to send to the House of Representatives through the Deputy Attorney General. I think it's ludicrous. There's no reason that he would be able to force the president to testify under circumstances where he would be using a grand jury to get testimony for basically an impeachment report. That would be an abuse of the grand jury process.
Joe DiGenova, thank you so much for taking this time, especially from overseas. It's great to talk with you, my friend. We'll talk with you again, hopefully, when you're back. In the meantime, stay well.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Gordon Chang, one of our country's preeminent experts on Asia and what things going on there might mean for the rest of us. He is, of course, the author of two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. You can find his writings at the Daily Beast, among other places, and of course he is a regular at Fox News, among other outlets. We're always pleased to have him at this one. Gordon, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Frank.
So, we have Kim Jong-un in China for the third time in recent weeks. He has, of course, in the interval since his last visit there, been to see President Trump in Singapore. What do you think is going on, Gordon, at the moment? The role that the Chinese are playing in this so-called denuclearization effort, and specifically how they are evidently undermining the sanctions regime at the moment.
Yes, this is extremely important because, as you point out, this is Kim's third straight trip to Chinese soil. I think that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, is trying to say to President Trump, look, the North Koreans are our vassals. We control this. You know, any solution to North Korea's nuclear crisis runs through Beijing. And also, this comes at a time of heightened trade tension with the United States. I think that the Chinese are trying to sort of make an implicit bargain here about trade for North Korea. But as you point out, the Chinese are violating sanctions. They're doing so openly. They're relaxing inspections at the border. And this comes after 3 months of being open about actually violating their obligations. This is something that President Trump needs to deal with, and it needs to deal with more than just rhetorically. He needs to start imposing costs on China.
So, Gordon, when you say he needs to deal with this, and obviously one of the ways he has been dealing with it, or trying to, has been direct negotiations with Kim Jong-un himself, leaving the Chinese out of the mix, the role that they have played until now under successive U.S. administrations of kind of the broker, the arbiter, the dictator of terms even. He seems to have been supplanted by this idea that, well, we'll say nice things about Kim and we'll say even nicer things about Xi Jinping, but we're going to deal with the former and not with the latter. Is that sustainable as you see it, or are the Chinese going to make it essentially impossible for the president to pursue that kind of diplomacy, if only by subverting the most important ingredient, arguably, of the maximum pressure on Kim Jong-un, namely the sanctions?
My sense is that China is purposefully undermining the sanctions. It has said that it wants those sanctions to be formally relaxed at the UN. And it's working to do that by actually not inspecting the goods that are crossing the border. As a number of newspaper outlets have pointed out, people on the Chinese side of the border express optimism now that they can do business with the North Koreans like they did in the past, which means in violation of UN rules. And so at this particular time, if we want to maintain those sanctions, and Secretary of State Pompeo said that while he was in Beijing a few days ago, standing next to Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, Pompeo said that the Chinese understand that the maximum pressure campaign has to remain until denuclearization is complete. The Chinese may be saying that to Pompeo, but that's not the way they're acting. And so if we want to maintain those sanctions, clearly we have got to now go after the Chinese for clear violations. And by the way, while we're on this topic, Frank, I'm disappointed in the administration in not designating new entities to be sanctioned. We know that the North Koreans change their front companies all the time. So if we don't designate the new front companies, we're allowing Kim Jong-un to hollow out those sanctions quickly. And so far, the president has said, look, he's holding off. So I think that we need to work on this. President Trump got the North Koreans to the bargaining table. He got them to make concessions by his maximum pressure campaign. Now he's relaxing it, and this is not a good sign that we're going to get the North Koreans to honor their commitments.
Yeah, you mentioned in one of your pieces recently, I believe it was at the Daily Beast, that the president has been making some rookie mistakes after seemingly handling rather well this Kim portfolio, shall we say. Give us some examples of what you think are those mistakes, and is there a sense that they're being rectified now by the Trump administration?
We got Kim to make a number of concessions, and this was really brilliant diplomacy on the part of the president through the end of last month. We got them to release the three Americans in May. We also got the North Koreans to make clear denuclearization pledges through Moon Jae-in, the South Korean president. We heard that after their first summit. The North Koreans suspended missile and nuke testing, which is less than it appeared. They destroyed part of the Punggye-ri nuclear test site. It was only the North Korean making concessions. And then at the summit, June 12th in Singapore, the president did not get as much as people thought he should. And the reason is he relaxed the pressure. He's allowed the Chinese to bust sanctions, as we've just talked about. He's allowed the North Koreans to hollow out sanctions, as we've just mentioned. And just incredibly, he decided to suspend the large-scale joint military exercises and not getting a commitment from the North Koreans to suspend their exercises. So he's allowed the pressure to come off. And I think that we're going to see the North Koreans are not going to be easy to deal with because of that. We need to maintain that pressure. And if we don't have it, I don't think there's going to be a good end to this. Now, this is not to say that the North Koreans are going to get away with this. We've got overwhelming leverage, but this is going to become a much more difficult exercise than it needed to be, and the president is going to have to work uphill.
Well, a sobering thought, and one that I hope will be taken very seriously by the Trump administration as it continues these negotiations with the North Koreans. Gordon, let me turn back to China for a moment. As we've been discussing for some time now, the president has thrown down the gauntlet with respect to the Chinese and trade. The latest turn of events is that the Chinese have reciprocated for the first $50 billion worth of sanctions the president has imposed by meeting him. And the president has said, well, he's going to up it to $100 billion in sanctions and, if necessary, $200 billion worth of sanctions. Talk a little bit about the Chinese response to all of this, the fact that apparently in addition to so-called quantitative measures that they're taking in retaliation or proposed to, they're also taking qualitative steps to squeeze American companies on the ground in China and the like.
Yeah, China, when it goes into this trade war, as people call it, I mean, China's been waging a trade war for a very long time. We're just responding. But China doesn't really have the tools. We've got overwhelming leverage. We're the trade deficit country. They're just dependent on the U.S. market in ways which is just unimaginable. And also, we're the much bigger economy. The only way that the Chinese can win a trade war is if they exercise political will, and we don't. What is significant about President Trump's announcement yesterday about an additional $200 billion in tariffs that he's considering is that it shows that the president is not going to fold, even though we hold the overwhelming leverage. I was afraid, of course, that the president would do that, but now he's indicated that he understands he has the upper hand and he's willing to see this to the end. This is a hooray for the president because this is an existential struggle, Frank. You know, if we allow the Chinese to do what they've been in terms of going after our companies in China, going after trade like they have, we're just not going to have a country. So this is one of those things where I think that the president deserves all of our support because we want to have a future going forward. So this is very, very good news.
Let me just reinforce a point that you made, Gordon, which I think does get missed oftentimes in these conversations, and that is, as the president has said as well, we have been involved in a trade war for many, many decades with the Chinese, and they have simply prevailed because we haven't regarded it as such, let alone fought back. He is trying to do that now, and as with you, I wish him the best. There is an interesting exception to that, of course, Gordon, and that was this case of ZTE, the Chinese telecommunications conglomerate, one of two that has been identified by U.S. intelligence and the military as engaged in a variety of espionage-related and other nefarious activities with respect to their technology in the United States. The Senate, I believe yesterday, voted to essentially repudiate a deal that the president struck with the Chinese to try to allow ZTE to continue doing business with support from American suppliers. Give us quickly what you think is going on there and what the right outcome is.
Well, the right outcome is that that deal be repudiated. We go back to the sanctions that were imposed in April of the 7-year ban on Americans selling or licensing anything to ZTE. So I do hope that the Senate ban is approved by the House, that it does become law, that that relaxation of sanctions as negotiated by the Commerce Department is repudiated. The Chinese have made this an open test of political will. So no deal, no matter how good it is good. And I think the deal that the Trump administration negotiated with the Chinese wasn't bad, especially when you consider some of the informal provisions that were not included. But as I said, once the Chinese made this a political will, that deal is just bad because it shows that the Chinese can push the U.S. around. That was why I was concerned about a number of things. Now I feel a bit better that the Senate's on the job. And I hope that President Trump sees this to the end, as I think that he will.
Well, we will be following it closely with your help, Gordon Chang. Good news is always welcome here. Thank you, my friend. As always, Gordon Chang, you are a national treasure. We appreciate your time so much. Next up, we'll drill down a little bit further on the North Korea situation with Greg Scarlett-Jewell. That and more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're joined, I believe, for the first time by Greg Scarlett-Jewell. He is a distinguished and very effective advocate for human rights in North Korea. He is the executive director of a committee for human rights in North Korea. Among other interesting incarnations, he has served as a visiting professor at Hankook University of Foreign Studies in Seoul, South Korea. He has been an instructor on Korea and Japan at the U.S. State Department's Foreign Service Institute, and a vice president of the executive board of the International Council on Korean Studies. In short, he knows his way around the Korean Peninsula, and we're anxious to talk with him about particularly what's been actually the ground truth on the northern side of the demilitarized zone as it relates particularly to the treatment by the Kim Jong-un version of the Kim dynasty's misrule there for the people of North Korea. Greg Scarlett Chua, it's so good to have you with us. Thank you very much for taking a few minutes to chat.
Frank, the honor is all mine, sir.
Well, good. Let me ask you about this business with North Korea and human rights. There have been, I think, in the course of the rather enthusiastic, shall we say, embrace by Donald Trump of Kim Jong-un, a gloss put on what's going on with respect to the people of North Korea and their lot in life that seems to me to be inaccurate, shall we say. Could you talk a little bit about how the people there, not interested in the party, I'm not interested in the leadership or the military, I'm talking about the people of North Korea, to say nothing of those that are considered enemies of the state, but just the daily lot in life, as I say, of the people there. How would you characterize it, Greg?
Frank, this is a regime that has spent tremendous amounts of money on areas that it regards as critical to its own survival, nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles. This is a regime that's also spent significant amounts of hard currency on keeping its elite happy. At the same time, 30% of North Korea's children are malnourished. The overwhelming majority of the people of North Korea continue to suffer from rather severe human insecurity that affects all aspects of life. And as you said, those who are perceived as enemies of the regime, wrongdoers, wrong thinkers, those perceived as having engaged in the wrong associations are punished very harshly. This is a regime that continues to run a gulag-style system of unlawful imprisonment, where 120,000 men, women, and children are imprisoned pursuant to a system of guilt by association, with up to three generations of the same family being punished for the perceived offenses of one individual.
And 120,000 would be roughly what percent of the population of North Korea? It's a rather large one, I think.
The population of North Korea today is 25 million people. And these are only political prisoners who are basically victims of enforced disappearances. They're just taken away in the middle of the night. They're not given prison sentences. Of course, there are political prisoners being held at other types of facilities. For example, at the Kyohwaso re-education through labor camps. People held at those facilities do get prison terms, but there are multiple types of detention facilities and abysmal human rights violations happen throughout North Korea's detention system.
And as you say, it is visited not just upon the alleged malfactor, but their extended family as well, which is additionally horrific in character. Let me ask you, there have been reports that Christians in North Korea are subjected to the worst persecution in the world today. Would you agree with that assessment, or at least you're in a position, I think, to characterize what befalls people for believing that there is a deity other than the Kim dynasty?
Absolutely, no doubt, Frank. There are currently almost 32,000 North Korean escapees in South Korea. I interview many of them. I work with many of them. Many of them are good and dear friends. Basically, if a North Korean is apprehended in China and forcibly repatriated to North Korea in direct violation of the 1951 UN Refugee Convention, during the very harsh interrogation, they're asked basically two questions. Did you come across any South Koreans? Did you come across any Christians? North Korea, the northern half of the Korean peninsula, used to be the cradle of the Korean Presbyterian Church. The capital city of Pyongyang used to be known as the Jerusalem of the East. Christianity was a religion and a way of life. You're talking two Christian churches on each street corner. The regime eradicated, exterminated Christianity with extreme brutality. And to this day, of course, through the good work, missionaries, there is an underground church. The numbers are fairly limited, but if one gets caught with a Bible, any kind of Christian material, if one is suspected of being a Christian or being associated with Christians, the punishment will be extraordinarily harsh.
Let me ask you, in light of all of this, and again, our guest is Greg Scarlatiou. He is a man deeply knowledgeable about conditions inside the, well, the Hermit Kingdom is, I think, the most benign description of it, but the Gulag state of North Korea. Greg, when the President of the United States is interacting with the chairman of the Communist Party, I guess it is, of North Korea, how important is it, as you see it, that those interactions be rooted in an accurate understanding of and an effort to address the character of the regime as it relates to its own people? I'm convinced, as I've said many times on this program, that a country that treats its own people very badly is unlikely to treat ours better. But your thoughts on the way the president should be handling this particular piece of the portfolio?
Diplomacy is important. Diplomacy should continue. Summit diplomacy is a tool that had never been tried before prior to the Singapore summit. That said, Frank, as you put it, it is very important to engage in informed, reasonable diplomacy that's fully knowledgeable and based on the past record. Otherwise, we're going to repeat the mistakes of the past. What we're seeing right now, human rights organizations and those concerned with North Korean human rights, is that, again, human rights has been outcompeted by nukes and missiles, very serious political, military, security issues. This is deja vu all over again. We have seen this. We have seen human rights being sacrificed on the altar of negotiating nuclear and missile issues for 3 decades now. Well, they didn't go too well. So perhaps it is time to factor in human rights as well as we approach the regime of Kim Jong-un, because these egregious human rights violations are still happening. The fundamental nature of the Kim regime has not changed. What Kim Jong-un wants is U.S. security guarantees. How can the United States of America, the leader of the free world, guarantee the survival of a regime that is committing crimes against humanity against its own people? Mm.
Knowing what you do, Greg Scarlatiou, of this regime, the assertion has been, as you know, that if only we promise them security and facilitate an economic transformation of the place, that this will raise all boats, that the people of North Korea will benefit, their conditions will dramatically improve. What is your response to that proposition?
Economic transformation without human rights observance is an impossible predicament. Yes, there is an informal market in North Korea, but property rights are not guaranteed. There is no such thing as private property. Fundamental human rights, freedom of assembly, freedom to engage in collective bargaining, this is simply a human rights black hole. This is simply a terrible environment for any foreign direct investor. Corruption is extraordinarily high. It would be simply a matter of sinking money into a black hole. In order to achieve a reasonable level of economic development, the regime of Kim Jong-un will have to change. It will have to begin to observe some fundamental human rights.
Yeah. Greg Scarlatiou, we appreciate so much the work you do at the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.